Hello, Exopolitics listeners. I'm R.V. Romero, Stellar Artistic Director of Exopolitics Radio. I'd like to thank you all for listening to our show and for taking an interest in the evolution of our planet and our species through Exopolitics Radio and the study of law and order in the universe. For over a year now, I've enjoyed working closely with your elusive host, Alfred Weber, on this fine production that we're proud to broadcast on a weekly basis and post free of charge on our website. Currently, I'm happy to say that in the last 90 days, ExopoliticsRadio.com has been visited by people in over 56 countries and 492 cities around the globe, including all 50 states in the U.S. During that time, we've averaged over 5,000 podcast downloads per show, and we're adding listeners every week with affiliates at Paranormal Radio, the Revere Radio Network, and most recently, Kansas City Online Radio. Now, I'm telling you all this to give you an update on how our show is progressing, and also to let you know that indeed, the number of intelligent people here on Earth who are catching on to the fact that there are other intelligent life forms in the universe is growing. And Exopolitics Radio is proud to be on the cutting edge of this revelation by reporting news and providing the insight and perspectives that you can't find anywhere else on the radio, in the newspapers, or on the television. We want to continue bringing you Exopolitics Radio both online and on air free of charge, as we always have, because we believe in the message and the content. However, as a studio and production team, we do have routine expenses which must be maintained in order to do so. It pains us to ask, and I promise we won't do it often, but if every listener online donated $1 a month, that would completely cover our production costs for the show and the immense amount of time spent doing research, interviews, and production time given graciously by our host. Of course, not every listener is going to be able to donate $1 or donate on a monthly basis, so if you could consider donating a little bit more, that would be a tremendous help and allow us to continue adding more and more affiliates, creating new programs, interviews, and materials, and most importantly, continue broadcasting this message of hope and truth around the globe and the universe. So whatever the outcome, I can promise you that we will continue working to bring you a unique and sincere program week in and week out, 12 months a year. So we thank you for your support of Exopolitics Radio. Please remember to go to www.exopoliticsradio.com and click on the donate menu option for more information. Thank you very much, and now back to the show.
The views expressed on Exopolitics Radio with Alfred Weber are the views of Alfred Weber, not specifically those of our on-air affiliates or our sponsors.
This is Exopolitics Radio, a weekly magazine format public affairs program on exopolitics, the new political science of outer space, the science of relations between our human civilization and other intelligent civilizations in the universe. Exopolitics Radio can be heard on 1480 AM KPHX Progressive Talk Phoenix and worldwide on the internet at www.exopoliticsradio.com. Our audio archives are www.exopoliticsradio.com. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Welcome back. This week we have a featured interview with author and researcher Lloyd Pye, author of the book The Starchild Skull, A Genetic Enigma or Human Alien Hybrid, which you will learn an artifact which Lloyd Pye has been researching as a possible hybrid Starchild skull. And Lloyd Pye and I will be presenting on April 5th, 2008 at the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia. The details are at www.exopolitics.com. And I think from an exopolitics perspective, and as part of our official Exopolitics Radio commentary for this week, what stands out the most from our reading of Lloyd Pye's research on the Starchild skull, if verified, and as it is verified, as it appears to be the skull carbon dated to approximately 900 years ago, of a child who is a hybrid of an alien, possibly gray father, and a terrestrial mother in Mexico. That one plausible scenario, which appears from the star visitor tales of that time, was that that child resulted from the abduction or the artificial impregnation or perhaps natural impregnation of the terrestrial mother, a villager, and that the child was, these hybrid children were left to live in the village until they were 7, 8, 9 years old, and then taken away by the aliens to some other location, perhaps off planet. And so if this is correct, what some of our earlier Exopolitics Radio guests, such as Jim Sparks, have been saying about the educational outreach and genetic farming program of the small grays, who apparently, both from Jim Sparks' research and from other whistleblowers, have simultaneously since the early 1950s have been engaged in top secret extraterrestrial human liaison programs with the U.S. government involving technology transfer such as teleportation, and at the same time, with the apparent knowledge and consent, have been carrying out large-scale abduction programs in the North American continent, perhaps elsewhere, under the guise of education outreach and genetic farming programs, and that this has been treated as something, quote, new. Well, what's remarkable about Lloyd Pye's research, as it is verified, is that this gray genetic farming program appears to have been going, and this is carbon dated and with DNA research confirmation now ongoing, appears to be occurring 900 years ago, as confirmed by carbon dating in the North American continent. So the picture is not as facilely presented as, oh, in 1947 or in 1960s, the Grays arrived and entered into a treaty with the military-industrial complex and entered into this secret human extraterrestrial liaison program by which they transferred technology and then entered into a secret genetic farming program. It appears as though we have in the Starchild skull, as this is verified, it's been verified by carbon dating and now by various genetic and other medical tests, that we may well have had gray hybrids resulting from abduction and impregnation, either by artificial insemination or by other means, natural means, going back to 900 years ago. So that's why we're calling for a decade of contact and bringing this matter out from under the active censorship of the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. military industrial complex, which by its policies, following the Robertson panel in 1952, have a formal policy. The $1.5 trillion black budget has a formal policy of harassing and ridiculing all witnesses, all UFO and extraterrestrial encounters, and all media persons and scientists and government officials and civilians and educators and just plain folk who experience and try to report on the extraterrestrial presence for unclear purposes. That is, it is unclear what the purposes are of the military to do this, because clearly the upper dimensionals are appearing freely and at will, as the Stephenville sightings and, you know, the Trout Lake Washington sightings and the Phoenix lights and many of the other sightings show, and they are not hostile. In fact, one can show that there's an integrated upper dimensional plan for bringing humanity and the planet Earth into its new home as cosmic citizens. And in fact, it's the plan of the permanent war economy embodied in the U.S. military-industrial complex as agents of the Rockefeller City of London, you know, kind of permanent war economy, petroleum, nuclear, civilization, you know, all of these pejorative adjectives and identification of elites that are implementing this embargo. Toward what end? To make a monopoly on relations with extraterrestrials? Now, that's absurd. To try and ward off and to hold humanity hostage? As if. So, here we have one more crack in the dam in terms of the Starchild skull. And those of you who are in Vancouver, British Columbia, or close thereby, and would like to fly in or drive up for this presentation, it will be on Saturday, April 5th, 2008, at the H.R. McMillan Space Center, 1100 Chestnut Street, Vancouver, British Columbia, at 7 p.m., and with details at www.exopolitics.com. This has been an official Exopolitics Radio commentary. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, and today we're with a very special guest, Lloyd Pye, who is an author and researcher. His book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, is a bestseller which has delved into the field of intervention theory, or the theory of origins of species, a fact-based alternative to evolution, creation, and intelligent design. And his current book, which we'll be discussing today, is The Starchild Skull, Genetic Enigma or Alien Hybrid. Incidentally, Lloyd and I will be giving a presentation at the H.R. McMillan Space Center, the planetarium in Vancouver, British Columbia, on April 5th, 2008. And all of the details are at www.exopolitics.com, and it should be a very interesting presentation. Lloyd will be speaking on his research on this possible hybrid Starchild skull, and I'll be giving a contextual presentation on exopolitics, the new political science of outer space. Well, welcome, Lloyd, to Exopolitics Radio.
Well, thank you, Alfred. I'm very happy to be with you, and I am very much looking forward to meeting you in person at the event in Vancouver on the 5th that you mentioned.
Thank you. Now, for those of our listeners, this is, of course, Exopolitics Radio, and we cover events in exopolitics, which is the emergent science of relations between human civilizations and intelligent civilizations in the universe. And for those of our listeners who may not have heard of your work or the Starchild skull, what is the Starchild skull?
Well, I think that the Starchild skull could well prove to be that it is not really an emerging field of study between humans and aliens from other places. The Starchild skull is a real, true bone skull that was dated without any question, you know, the way they do it with carbon-14, dated at 900 years ago. So this is a skull that we know was on Earth and died 900 years ago. And this skull has all the hallmarks, scientifically speaking, of not being entirely human. It does seem to be, from everything we can determine at this point, to be a hybrid between an alien mother and a father that was not entirely human. He may have had some aspects of him human, or maybe not. Could have been a complete pure alien. We don't know that yet. We just know that he wasn't entirely human in that his DNA could not be recovered. The DNA of the mother could and was, so we know that she was human. But there are very, very great questions about its father, and that's what we need to continue pursuing, is not just to establish that he wasn't human, but to establish what he was.
Okay. Now, lead us through the story and through the various milestones that led you to all of those remarkable conclusions.
Well, the skull was originally found in the 1930s, about 1930, by a woman who at the time was just a teenager, and it was found in Mexico, about 100 miles southeast of Chihuahua. And she was there visiting her parents' home village, and in that area, which is sort of near the Copper Canyon area, there were mine tunnels, old ancient mine tunnels and caves, much like the American Southwest. And she was told not to go in any of them, that it was dangerous. It was a taboo thing for them to do. Well, being a teenager, you know, she snuck off to explore, and she did find a very isolated and abandoned, long abandoned mine tunnel, and she went in. And there on the ground, on the floor of the mine tunnel, as she described it, she found a human being lying on its back, the skeleton of a human, in which she recognized at that time. She had seen a number of skeletons. She knew what one looked like. And then she got closer, she realized that there was a hand, a bony hand of another skeleton sticking up out of the dirt beside the one laying on the ground, and that hand was wrapped around the upper arm bone of the one laying on the ground. She didn't understand it at the time, but we surmise that that human being lying on the ground, whoever she was, had taken the one that was in the ground up into that mine tunnel, buried it, left its hand sticking out, wrapped its hand around her own arm, and then she killed herself. Because I don't see how you can get that scenario, as the woman described it, any other way. So the girl realized that there was a body in the dirt underneath, you know, the mine tunnel floor, and she scraped it away with her hands, a very shallow grave, and found these bones of another being that she described as misshapen. Basically, the word she used was misshapen, smaller than the one on the surface, which was itself only about 5 feet tall, and based on the size of the skull. And the other one, she said, was noticeably smaller, so we had put that in the range of about 4 feet tall. And she ended up recovering the two skulls. It's a long story of what she went through that I recount in the book, The Star Child Skull, for anyone who wants to get all the details of this story. And if they can't come to the presentation on April 5th, then there is a book available. It's called The Star Child Skull, available on Amazon, easy to get, and you can read all this. But anyway, she recovered the skulls, brought them back to the country, kept them as souvenirs, had no idea what they were, except just, you know, she assumed it was a deformity. She assumed that the one that was strange-looking was just a deformity. She had no reason to think otherwise. So when she got old in the early 90s and was diagnosed with a terminal illness, she willed the skulls to be given to friends of hers, or asked them if they would take them. And they were just two skulls in a cardboard box, and they said yes, they would, and they did, and they kept them for 5 years. Then they gave them to they got uncomfortable with them, and, you know, having two skulls in your garage, kind of weird, gave them to another couple that they thought might be more comfortable with them, Ray and Melanie Young of El Paso, because Melanie and her earlier life had been a neonatal nurse for many years. She had her own massage therapy clinic by then, but in her early years, she was a neonatal nurse. And she knew upon almost first sight that that skull was not a normal human deformity. She had seen enough deformity to know. But more importantly, she and her husband, Ray, were members of the El Paso MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. So they were very knowledgeable about UFOs, alien beings, and what the skull of a gray alien might look like. And to their eyes, to Melanie's well-trained eyes, that skull looked like the skull that would fit inside the head of a gray alien. So they contacted me and asked me if I would do what it would take to try to confirm that, which I immediately set about doing. I was very excited. I thought, you know, I assumed starting that it would be some kind of a deformity, would prove out to be a deformity, because I couldn't visualize myself actually holding the head of a, you know, the skull of a gray alien. It just, that's like the shepherd finding the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, it just, I couldn't conceive of it. So, but as we began to do the scientific testing that I had agreed to do, we began to determine more and more facts that indicated that it wasn't really a normal human at all. And so we found a number, I mean, a couple of dozen things to recount that were substantially different from normal human skulls. And as each of those unfolded, again, the story that's told in the book and that will be related verbally at the event on April 5th, we could only come to the conclusion that, geez, this is the real deal. This thing is what we think it is. It is not entirely human. It is a human-alien hybrid. And that's pretty much where we stand right now. We know that the mother was human and that the father wasn't human. We are now to the point of needing to prove beyond any shadow of doubt what he was exactly. And for a long time, we've known what we know about the Star Child since 2003. We've known that. Summer of 2003, we did the genetic testing that proved it. But to say that he's not human, that his DNA does not respond to the primers that are used to recover normal human DNA, it doesn't prove that he's an alien. It just proves that he isn't a normal human. In order to prove that he's an alien, we have to know how far his DNA lies from the standard measurements that we have for establishing human DNA. Now, if at 2003 there was no way to do that. But now, within the last couple of years, a test has been developed, a very expensive test, mind you, and a very extensive test in which you recover an entire genome. That means all of the base pairs in the genome, all 3 billion of the base pairs in the 20 to 25,000 genes in the 46 chromosomes that we all human beings have. It can all be recovered now, every piece of it. And it's being done to the Neanderthal DNA, to some Neanderthal DNA as we speak right now, because science wants that question answered. So as soon as the technology was available, all that was available of it was applied to recovering Neanderthal DNA. And that's a good thing to recover. But the day will come, probably in 2009 or 2010, when we will be able to arrange for a test of the Star Child's DNA by this particular equipment. And when we can do that, we will be able to establish firmly, clearly, convincingly what the Star Child's DNA package was like. And therefore, out of that will come what its father's DNA package was like. And we will be able to establish on a scale of from human moving away from human, we will be able to establish on that scale where both the Star Child and his father will be positioned. And the difference will determine whether or not the Star Child or the father will be accepted as alien, because what are the boundaries? What are the perimeters? What are the scaling measures? It's this. 3% from normal human is a chimp. A little more than that is a gorilla. So you see what I mean? You're talking about only 3% difference for a chimp, which is a very, very different being relative to a human. So when the Star Child's DNA is sequenced out with this new technology, we will be able to put it down, as they will soon, in another year or so, they'll be able to put the Neanderthal DNA where it fits on that scale. Does it fit closer to a chimp or closer to a human? That's what every scientist wants to know. Where does the Neanderthal fall? Was it more human? Was it more primitive? And we'll have that answer eventually. Same thing with the Star Child. The Star Child will fall somewhere on that scale. Will it fall within 3% from human, or will it fall outside 3% from human? It could be 10% different than human and still look as it does, because it has so many fundamental biological differences that we've already determined. People are just ignoring this, Alfred. The basic truth of it is people are just ignoring this because, frankly, most people don't want this question answered definitively. And that's the thing that the Star Child can do, can provide, is a definitive answer about UFO, well, alien reality, and one would have to assume UFO reality as well. It will change our world as we understand it, and it will do it with proof to such a degree that it cannot be denied. Now, that's a very long answer to your question, but I think it covers most of the bases.
You're listening to our Exopolitics Radio interview with author and researcher Lloyd Pye. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Let's now rejoin our feature interview with author and researcher Lloyd Pye on the Star Child Skull. Thank you. There are two different directions that I would like to suggest we take the conversation, but first, just to ask, one of the standard questions that comes up about the Star Child skull, and that is, can you differentiate it from a medical condition known as hydrocephaly? Hydrocephaly. And I wondered if you could just address that question, because that's what the skeptical community has thrown up as an initial barrier here.
Right. Well, the skeptical community has really nowhere to turn to answer all of the many, many things that are different about the Star Child. So what they do is they look at its physical features and they just say, oh, it has a swollen head. That has to be hydrocephaly. And oh, the rear of its head is flat. That has to be cradle boarding. When I first would take it out, Alfred, almost every scientist that I would take it to that had a stake in that field would say, oh, that's a cradle boarded hydrocephalic. You don't need to worry about that. That's a cradle boarded hydrocephalic. Just take it back where you got it and forget about it. Don't even give it another thought. There's no question that is a cradle boarded hydrocephalic. Well, when you look at hydrocephaly and what it's really about, what it is it's water on the brain. It's pressure either on the surface of the brain, between the brain and the skull itself, or it's pressure created within the brain, pressing the brain up against the bone. But in either case, the inward, upward, and outward pressure distends the skull often tremendously. I mean, you can get hydrocephalics that are the size of basketballs before they die. I mean, it can go really outrageously out of shape, but they are never symmetrical. They are never really beautiful to look at. The Star Child is incredibly symmetrical. It's more symmetrical, in fact, than the average human head. It's more symmetrical than the head that was found with it. It is incredibly symmetrical. Now, that is not a hallmark of hydrocephaly. But more important than that, if you look at the Star Child, and you can very easily go to the website, www.starchildproject.com. That's www.starchildproject.com, and see these pictures. No, you know, we're not hiding anything. And you will see that there is a neat, noticeable, distinctive crease in the upper rear of the Star Child's skull, very much like the crease described in the upper rear of the heads of grays. That was one of, in fact, the hallmark things that tipped Melanie Young off. This isn't a deformity, this isn't hydrocephaly, because if it was, it was caused by pressure. The pressure is always uniform as it presses up from the brain and from on the brain or in the brain. It's uniform. So the outward pressure does not allow for a neat, distinctive, symmetrical crease in the rear of the head. Now, every scientist that I would show this to knew that. They knew that. they just wanted to get rid of me. They didn't want to confront and deal with this horrible anomaly from the position that they'd come from, because it's going to upset their world, and they know it. They would get so upset when I would start challenging them, Alfred, when I'd say, hey, wait a minute, no, that can't be hydrocephaly, because they'd say, look, just okay, I've told you what I thought, you can go ask someone else. They would just get rid of me. They would get angry with me. So, and I get angry with them when I think about the incredible stupidity and narrow-mindedness and shallow-mindedness of the people who come up with that. It's the best they can come up with. There is no other, just no answer for the Starchild skull. So they just go to the simplest, most basic, fundamental answer they can come up with, and they just don't want to hear that it's just a wrong and even a stupid response to something that is so clearly anomalous and deserves so much more of their respect than they're willing to give it.
Right. Oh, okay. Now, having disposed of that issue, I would like to go back to the DNA issue. And have you been able to, I know that there is a huge rumor mill in the exopolitics and in the extraterrestrial field that of there being possible other extraterrestrial DNA present on the planet in, you know, various contexts ranging from the Roswell extraterrestrials to other situations that may be in private researchers' hands. Have you been able to come across other DNA samples other than the Starchild skull that would possibly be of extraterrestrial origin?
No DNA samples, no, because okay. This is not something that gets DNA tested. For example, I think if you ask me, well, are there any other skulls in the world that one might consider to be alien? I would say yes.
Yeah.
The Starchild stands alone by itself. There's nothing like it out there. But there are hundreds, literally hundreds, of what are called the conehead skulls down in Peru.
That's right.
Now, the conehead skulls, in my opinion, stand a very good chance of being equally alien as the Starchild. I mean, it's far away from the human norm as the Starchild if they could be tested genetically. But so far as I know, and I've been doing this Starchild thing for 8 years now.
Right.
Almost 9. So as far as I know, still, and I've been saying to anyone that will listen, the coneheads ought to be tested. Somebody ought to take some DNA from a conehead and test it out and see what they get. As far as I know, that has not been done. If I had ever had the money, I would have, you know, could have
right.
accessed one of them. I would have had it done first thing, because they are as anomalous in their own way. Again, they're nothing like the Starchild.
Right.
But in their own way, they are equally anomalous, and I would think that they might well turn out to be a race or a tribe or however you want to put it, of beings that were also not entirely human.
Now, because I'm just thinking that you're mentioning this testing sequence, that may be coming up in 2009.
Well, it's available now, Alfred. We just don't have the money, because it's an extremely expensive test. When you talk about sequencing an entire genome, 3 billion base pairs, you're talking about an enormous amount of lab time that has to be paid for. You have to pay for the equipment that does the work. Now, science is willing to foot the bill to do the Neanderthal because, again, that's what something they want. They want that answer. This is not something science is willing to foot the bill for, because they don't want this answer. Government doesn't want this. Religion doesn't. All of the funding sources that you would normally think of, they don't want this answer to be finalized. So we get no help with the Starchild at all.
Yeah. This is just the odd thought, okay? And you may have thought about it. But would it make sense to join as a control a Starchild skull with a conehead skull and to move forward with a testing of both, or would that double the cost?
That would double the cost, and really all you have to prove is one. Because if the Starchild got proved out as alien, you can bet the very next skull that would be done would be a conehead skull.
Right.
In other words, once the door is open, once the light is shining, once scientists can't hide in the shadows of ignorance anymore, and they have to just fess up and go to work and do what they're supposed to be doing the whole time, then the chains are good. Everybody will be unshackled. They can go to work. The ones that want to work on this, that have a taste for it but can't because of peer pressure, will be free to do it. So the evidence is going to start rolling in. Just You know, there was a time, and I talk about this in my book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, there was a time when you simply could not make the suggestion that there were human beings on the North American continent prior to 10,000 years ago, because that was the accepted belief and the accepted knowledge, and that was that. You just couldn't say it. And if you found evidence, if you were a scientist and an archaeologist, anthropologist, you found evidence of habitation prior to 10,000 years, you just didn't do anything with it. You couldn't, because you would be ostracized from your, you know, you would be excommunicated from the faith. You would just be in terrible trouble. And some who tried it found that that happened. But then eventually there was one spear point lodged in a bison that was so unalterably able to be proven to be 12,000 years. I mean, just beyond 10,000, no question. Once those shackles were undone, suddenly evidence for it started popping up all over the place. They right. could see what they didn't want to see past mean? That point. You know the old story about Columbus's ships when they came on to the shore of the islands of some of the natives, and the natives would swear they couldn't see them, that they were sitting right there and they couldn't see them because it was so different from their worldview, their minds just wouldn't let them see. Science is very much like that with what it doesn't want to know about, with what it doesn't want to deal with. And it stays as blind as those savages until something drops the veil and they can then finally see and are willing to see. And then the evidence is all over the place. And that's what will happen here. Right. It will be at just almost an overnight conversion. One tipping point will be reached. It could well be the Star Child. And when that happens, there will just be an avalanche.
Yes, yes, exactly. Now, this segment has been very exciting, and it just moves so quickly. We have about 8 minutes, and I think we've earned the right now to move into some higher order questioning and speculation of what we like to do in the exopolitics area. And we've had guests on like Jim Sparks, who spent 15 years with a lot of time in the Grays, in the, quote, abduction, kind of an educational and genetic farming outreach program. And the thoughts that came to me as I was reading your research, Lloyd, is that if we look at this as a Gray, take it from as a working hypothesis of the Gray Father, then that would fit within the model of what we call the Gray abductions impregnation of genetic farming, starting from the 1960s forward, where you may have the outreach and abduction, i.e. taking a human mother up into a craft, impregnating her with the sperm of a Gray, perhaps through an artificial insemination process, and then the mother serves as the womb. And so here was a process that, because that began in earnest in North America after the arrangement, apparently through the testimony of Jim Sparks and other whistleblowers, of the arrangement between U.S. military intelligence and this one specific extraterrestrial civilization that are known as the Short Grays. They may come from the constellation Orion. We're beginning to find out more. Your data, which is now carbon dated, going back 900 years, with his DNA samples, provides a scientifically tested data point that blows this wide open, because I would submit that it suggests that we're having the genetic farming program of the Grays with possible abduction of the woman up into a spacecraft, artificial insemination going on 900 years ago in the year 1100 or 1000, when we thought that this was a phenomenon happening in the 1960s forward. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, actually, I discussed that in some degree of detail in my book, The Star Child Skull, because while I was out and doing this research, a woman named Paula Gunn Allen, who is an emeritus professor at UCLA, contacted me, and she had done a lot of her research in her career as an academic, because she is part Native American, with studying old stories, old traditions of the Native peoples. And it turns out that all of them, or certainly the great majority of them, have a tradition of what is called the star beings. And in their tradition, the star beings do exactly that. They would come down, they would take a woman from a village, they would announce that she was going to be pregnant. Usually she was a barren woman, a woman who had either no children or no husband and no children, but a woman able to devote full time to care of this very special being that she was going to have. And the star beings would say that she's going to give birth, and you, the whole village, are taxed with the job of, you know, kind of like Hillary Clinton, it takes a village. You all are responsible for this being, raising it up and getting it to the age of 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, at which point we're going to come back and get it, which they would do. And so initially that we interpreted a lot of that to fit in with the scenario of the star child. Maybe that was the mother, the woman that was found with it. We later learned it was a woman, that she might have been its mother, and she didn't want them to take her child, or her child died, and it was like, oh, my God, the whole village is going to get wiped out for this. I'm going to hide the body, and I'm going to die with it, and maybe they won't kill the whole village. And, or, you know, we had a number of scenarios worked out as possibilities, but in the end, the DNA proved that she was not its mother. The woman that died with it was not its mother. She could have been a caretaker, could have been a friend, a lover, we don't know, but whatever she wasn't its mother. But based on the star being legends, which are out there and are widely, you know, widely believed, or were widely believed, and frankly, I think that's the case all around the world. I think we are basically a planet of guinea pigs, and we are used as aliens wish, and I don't think that they negotiate with anybody to do that, frankly. They don't need to. We don't have any power in a negotiation with them. They just do what they want. I see the aliens as like we are to animals, to animals that are beneath us. We take what we want. We band them. We tag them. We do whatever. We study them however we want, whenever we want, harm them however we want, help them however we want. We do whatever we want. We, I think, are the lab rats. I don't think it's a negotiation. I don't think it's anything like we stand on equal footing with them. We can't offer them anything in return for negotiation. I just think they do what they want with us when they want to do it, and it's up to us to figure it out. And I think that'll happen down the line, but I don't see it anytime soon.
But well, at least as to this particular species of extraterrestrials, the Agrees, as opposed to other species.
Well, I mean, it's obvious, at least in this one case, it looks very obvious that there was a mating between a human and a gray that produced a hybrid that had very much gray-like tendencies. Really not a lot of the human in that, in the star child. It's much more not human.
Yes, right. And there seem to be clear parallels, Lloyd, from what I can see, as to the genetic farming that took place in the 1980s and 90s that is described by contactees like Jim Sparks.
I think it's just a continuation of a program that's gone on forever. The only difference I see is that when the world got small because of communications, where you couldn't just put a child like that in an isolated village and nobody else would know about it but that village and those few villages around it, they, instead of letting them go to term with the women and being raised up for the first 5 or 6 or 7 years, they take them out in the second trimester and raise them in, you know, let them come to term in bottles, and they miss out on a lot of nurturing. If they have humanity in them, which I think they do as hybrids, they need emotional nurturing that mothers and others can provide. And I don't think that that the test tube ones, the bottle gestated ones, get that. And I think that's where a lot of the people who disappear and end up on milk cartons might well be being abducted and taken wherever, so that they can interact with these beings and give them the kind of emotional sustenance that they need to grow up and function the way the aliens want them to do it, wherever they want them to do it. There's obviously a place out there where those beings go that is physiologically suited to them, and they need physical traits that come from this planet, from us, and they come and get them.
Well, that's a very challenging analysis and observation. I look forward, Lloyd, to meeting you and to our joint presentation on April 5th, 2008 at the H.R. McMillan Space Center in Vancouver, B.C. I really have found this, the implications of the star child skull, I think really crack archaeology and anthropology wide open. Where, again, can our listeners access that on the internet?
www.starchildproject, all one word, starchildproject.com, and they can get the book. It's called The Star Child Skull, and it can be obtained through Amazon. I would urge everybody to go there. It's the cheapest way you can do it. Amazon.com, The Star Child Skull by Lloyd Pye.
Thank you very much. This is Exopolitics Radio. We've been with author and researcher Lloyd Pye. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Please stay tuned. Thank you.
Exopolitics Radio with Alfred Weber.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Well, the usual sort of first line of defense of the skeptics or those who want to place barriers against considering the extraterrestrial presence is, where's your proof? There is no material proof of an extraterrestrial presence. So we've just completed a program on what you could call, is it the smoking gun? I wish that there were a happier metaphor. Let's call it material evidence, material proof, potential material proof in terms of the skull, carbon dated, and now with DNA analysis ongoing, which well may show that this skull is of an individual which could only be a hybrid of a terrestrial and an extraterrestrial being. QED, quod est demonstratum. And so this is part of the breaking of the dam and part of the shifting of the paradigms, whereby this 900-year-old skull of, you know, gray human ET hybrids that were ongoing with their genetic farming program 900 years ago, as in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, continuing, was happening then. So the complexity of our exopolitical relations continue, and we urge you to support our proposals for a decade of contact, indeed for an eternity of contact. This is Exopolitics Radio, which is produced by Phoenix Productions in conjunction with 1480 KPHX, Progressive Talk Phoenix, executive producer Richard Romero Sr., director R.V. Romero, producer and editor Chris Romero. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, wishing you a wonderful, miracle-filled, and star-child-accompanied day, week, and life. Thank you.